Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me tonight as tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger. By now well-known as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights, Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of arenas.
Good morning, or good afternoon, rather. We're voting in an election as we face a 100-year storm in the area of public health, simultaneous to an atmosphere of distrust, unrest, and division. States have tried to enable some modicum of social distancing as the election goes forward, utilizing such tools as mail-in or expanded absentee ballots and opening regional voting centers days or even weeks of the official election day.
The validity of the election itself, as well as public health and political unrest, are all hanging on a precipice. Where will all this lead? Our topic tonight, how will they succeed in maintaining relative safety during the pandemic without sacrificing the integrity of the democratic process? What will our democracy look like when all of this is over? As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're in the Bay Area, if you're outside the Bay Area, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You're not limited to exactly where we are in our discussion. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. That is any question related to the constitutional implications of this moment in time. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. To help us sort out just what's going on out there tonight, Erwin Chemerinsky is dean and professor of law at Berkeley School of Law and the author of leading casebooks and treatises about constitutional law.
Dr. John Eastman, presently on leave from Chapman University Fowler School of Law. He's serving as the visiting scholar in conservative thought and policy at the University of Colorado Boulder, and he's formerly a clerk of Justice Clarence Thomas of the United States Supreme Court.
And Bradley W. Hertz is a partner at the Sutton Law Firm, formerly an adjunct professor teaching election law and civil procedure at Chapman University School of Law. Bradley is a past president of the California Political Attorneys Association and election law, an author of several articles, most recently Democracy in the Time of COVID-19, particularly timely given the election that's now underway. And with that, let me welcome you all, Professor Eastman, Dean Chemerinsky, Mr. Hertz. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Great to be with you.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to be here.
You know, let me start with Brad Hertz. You could lay us a basic foundation of some of the things that you're seeing in the way of procedures that have changed, what you're seeing on the ground and how you're advising clients.
Sure. Thank you, Jeff. So, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We, of course, went through this exercise in the year 2000 with concerns about a close election that ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court in December of 2000. And yet 2004 came along. We worried that that would be just as bad or worse, and it wasn't. We are in a very unusual time because of, like you said, kind of a perfect storm of events. But democracy is messy. As Winston Churchill said, it's the worst form of government except for all the others. There is cause for concern given the rapidly changing environment in terms of vote by mail, ballot harvesting, the need to compare signatures, and everything comes down to a human factor. As much as we've tried to improve things in the last 20 years, we don't have hanging chad and we don't have people's eyes bulging out at a recount yet, but we still have a system that relies on election workers, campaign workers, the candidates themselves. And when you add to the mix the rapidly changing electoral environment and the divisiveness, it's going to be a very interesting couple of weeks, or more likely couple of months.
You know, in your answer you mentioned changing both in terms of the environment and some of the procedures. And this brings me to a note that you and I discussed before going on the air, Dr. Eastman. Maybe you'd like to comment on that, about some of the concerns about some of these changes that are happening as the election's underway.
Well, yeah. So it's long been the case that the Supreme Court is highly suspect of changes in procedures close to an election. And we've had a lot. We've got a couple hundred litigations going on around the country that are seeking to change access to absentee ballots over what state law requires, seeking to change who can turn in the absentee ballots, contrary in many instances to what state law requires, changing the verification process for those ballots, and also the changing the date that they have to be delivered. And of course, those kinds of rules change and lend themselves to gamesmanship by the opposing parties in the election. It's why the Supreme Court doesn't normally allow last minute changes to procedures. And a lot of this is being driven by concerns about COVID and what have you. But, you know, I just don't think changing the rules in the middle of the game is the right resolution here.
And I can see from your.
If I might,
I was just going to invite you.
The Supreme Court has said that federal courts should not change the rules of the election soon before the election. That comes from a Supreme Court per curiam opinion in Purcell versus Gonzalez. The Supreme Court takes a very different approach if states choose to do it on their own. So when federal courts in Alabama and Texas wanted to expand absentee ballots and change the requirements, the Supreme Court said no, albeit it was 5-4 split along ideological lines. But when Rhode Island officials on their own decided to change the rules for absentee ballots, the Supreme Court said that was permissible and didn't upset that. And I think John tremendously minimizes the pandemic that we're in the midst of. 220,000 people have died. The challenge is, how do we protect the right to vote while not putting people's health in danger?
Well, there's also provision on the U.S. Constitution that says the legislatures are to decide the manner of choosing electors. And when you've got public health officials or the governor unilaterally changing absentee return deadlines, when you've got state court judges or in some instances federal court judges opening an extension in Michigan, for example, the courts there have ordered that people can turn in their ballots up to 2 weeks after the election day and quote, without regard to the postmark on the ballot. This is a tremendous opportunity for chaos in the election. And it's being driven. 2 weeks, seriously. We're going to put on hold if it's a close election waiting on Michigan. We're going to hold everybody for 2 weeks while people go out and you know, ostensibly collect more ballots after the election, because we've now got a deadline 2 weeks after the election day. The Constitution says Congress gets to set the date of the election. The Constitution says the legislatures of the state, not the courts of the state, not the governor of the state, not the public health officials of the state, decide what the process for choosing electors is. And those state laws are being voided right now and changing the rules after people have already started voting.
John, I very much disagree with what you're saying. The state courts get to interpret state constitutions. State constitutions protect the right to vote. State courts can do what's appropriate in that regard. So it's completely appropriate for the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to interpret the Pennsylvania Constitution to say that absentee ballots will be accepted so long as they're received by November 6th. Now, in Bush versus Gore, 3 of the 9 justices, and only 3, Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas, took this position that courts couldn't protect the right to vote, only legislatures can do so. No majority of the court has ever taken that. I fear that 4 justices took that position on Monday with regard to Pennsylvania, but it was still only 4 justices. Marbury versus Madison said, it's the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. And that includes state courts get to interpret state constitutions.
But the state courts are not holding that the state statute is unconstitutional. The state statute in Pennsylvania, as the state statute in Michigan, specifically says that absentee ballots have to be received by the election board before the close of the polls on election day. And those state courts have just unilaterally said, well, we're going to extend that by 3 or 4 days. There's no question of the constitutionality of that statute. All of us, but they're changing the rules in the game. And that's it's a due process. process violation. There are all sorts of problems with that. You don't allow the change in the rules after the game has started. And that's what's going on in hundreds of jurisdictions around the country.
John, your rhetoric about not changing the rules of the game ignores the context. We're in the midst of a pandemic, and the goal is to facilitate the right to vote. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court didn't do this in some arbitrary make-it-up way. There's a provision in the Pennsylvania Constitution that protects the right to vote. It's a fundamental right. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court said to protect the right to vote in a pandemic, we're going to say absentee ballots have to be received by 3 days after the election, November 6th. This is the Trump rhetoric of keep people from voting.
How is it possibly any different because of the pandemic that you got to turn your ballot in before election day? You mail it 3 days ahead of time, just like we've always had to do. This is extending a deadline that's directly contrary to state law. And I'm sorry, I don't think the courts have that authority to say, well, this is some amorphous right to vote. It's the same right to vote that everybody else has, the same rules that everybody else has. You get your ballot in before the close of the polls. Everybody knows that. To extend it for 3 days is bad enough, as Pennsylvania has done. To extend it for 2 weeks is just unconscionable, as the courts up in Michigan have done.
May I respond?
Please do.
The right to vote needs to be protected. All the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said was the ballots have to be received within 3 days after the election. Why is that? Because we know from primaries in many states that people who mailed in their ballots long before the election still didn't have them received in time. In Wisconsin, there was a huge backlog in terms of processing and then delivering the absentee ballots back to the state. Again, I disagree with your premise that only the legislature can do this, because I think courts can do it. But even more, I think you're ignoring the need to protect the right to vote in a pandemic. I think it is really sad that Trump's position is less voting is better. So let's try to not have people be able to vote. I think we should all try to maximize the ability of people to vote and have their votes counted.
I'm sorry, Warren. He's not said less voting is better. What he said is everybody's got to play by the same rules. And when you're changing the rules after the election has already started, that lends itself to serious concerns. So, for example, in Michigan, you know, let's say you're right, that the post office has been delayed in getting ballots out. Where do you get the rule that we can turn ballots in after the fact for up to 2 weeks without regard to the postmark? That means people can mail these ballots in even after Election Day, even after projections are what's happening on Election Day. The opportunity for fraud there and gamesmanship is when already the country is each other's throats is just too great to be changing these rules at the last minute.
Let me go back to Pennsylvania for a moment. What the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, so long as the ballot is received by November 6th, it will be counted, unless there's proof by preponderance of the evidence that the ballot was turned in after November 3rd. I think that's such a sensible standard. Let's go back to the basic question. Should we be facilitating the ability of people to vote absentee in the midst of a pandemic? That's what I think we're disagreeing about here.
It's not at all. People can still vote absentee. There's no question about that. The question is, do we eliminate longstanding state law that says if you're going to vote absentee, the ballot has to be received by the county clerk before the close of polls. Otherwise, the opportunity for gamesmanship. And this is particularly true because we have learned that the post office often doesn't stamp these pre-franked mails. And if the Pennsylvania court says the burden is on you to challenge unless there's a preponderance of the evidence that this was mailed after the election day. Well, if it doesn't have a postmark, how do you prove that? The opportunity for fraud there is massive. And when people are already suspicious, to change the rules and to allow that opportunity to take root, I think is dangerous, quite frankly.
Let me jump in for a moment.
Go ahead,
Brad.
I was going to say, from the California perspective, we certainly have had some changes to liberalize and make easier and more user-friendly the process. But there also are safeguards that have been put in place. So, for example, with your vote-by-mail ballot, you can now track it just like you would a UPS or a FedEx package. There are highly trained workers making sure there aren't double votes that are counted. There are, you know, provisional ballots that can be cast that are then double-checked. So they say sunshine is the best disinfectant. Hopefully, with all the scrutiny we're having, we're going to see less fraud, more care taken at the electoral level, and an outcome that everyone can accept and live with.
I'm going to take a caller first, but I want you to think about a couple variables that may factor into the mix we've been talking about. One of those variables are changes at the post office that are taking place right now, where sorting machines have been set aside, whether those are antiquated or whether those are actually still in use and their service has been interrupted. Additionally, there have been cuts in salary and layoffs. I understand that the post office has fiscal problems of its own, but how does that fit into the elections that we've been talking about? The other is in California in particular. I can't speak to other states, but in California, we have an issue that's arisen where one of the major political parties has placed drop boxes for the ballots, initially labeling them as official ballot drop locations, then changing that in response to threatened litigation by the Attorney General and the governor, but and the Secretary of State, rather. They've taken away the official. They're somewhat distinguishable. But I'm going to ask you how that fits into the mix in a moment. I want to give you a moment to think about it and take this call from Howard in San Jose. Howard, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, everybody. I was listening to your very lively conversation about changing the rules so very close to an election. And I was wondering, well, okay, so clearly there's like a debate about what does it mean to have good timing about changing rules in an election year to accommodate things that are happening. So I guess I'm wondering, well, then what would be considered appropriate timing to change election rules? I mean, we've been in this pandemic since the beginning of the year, but what if the pandemic had only begun like last month? What if I'm in California, so what if the stay-at-home order from March only happened like right now and I couldn't physically leave my house for the next 2 weeks in a shelter-in-place order? So I'm like, okay, I understand timing is contentious, but what is considered good timing then, and what is considered okay to like change things in a unusual timing situation?
This is Brad. I can speak just from a practical matter. I don't know if you can say, thank goodness it was March instead of last week. But, you know, since everything started in March, cooler heads have tried to prevail. Election officials, legislatures, governors have said, what can we do about this? How can we keep people safe? How can we enable the election to go forward as constitutionally required? And so we have had the better part of 6 months to make these changes. In California, you'll see a lot of people saying, make a plan. How are you going to vote? How are you going to vote early? Are you going to drop it off because you don't trust the mail? So there's no perfect timing, but we have had months to consider this and to try to adapt the rules to the unusual circumstances.
I worry that when we talk about changing the rules for the election, that sounds very abstract. And no one wants to change the rules of the game. On the other hand, when we start talking about specifics, it makes a lot more sense. Let me go back to the example of Rhode Island. Rhode Island was one of the states that said in order to turn an absentee ballot, you either have to have it notarized or signed by two witnesses. The Rhode Island election officials decided to change that rule because of the pandemic to allow absentee ballots without that requirement. The Supreme Court allowed that. The Supreme Court rejected the challenge to it. Now, unfortunately, when federal district courts tried to do the same thing for the same rule in Alabama, the Supreme Court said, no, federal courts can't change the rule. I think it makes great sense to change that rule in a pandemic to make it easier for people to vote absentee without endangering their health. And I think the court did exactly the right thing by not getting involved.
Let me go back, Jeff, to your question about the box. California changed the law on absentee ballots a couple of years ago. It allows what we call ballot harvesting. It used to be that you could only cast a ballot if you had a particular medical reason. And then California expanded it further to if you were for some reason going to be unable to go to the poll because you were traveling on work or what have you. And then we expanded it, and anybody can ask for an absentee ballot, but you still had to turn it in yourself, mail it back yourself, or have an immediate family member turn it in. That changed a couple years ago. And now anybody can turn in those ballots. It puts at risk the confidentiality of the secret ballot. It raises the possibility or the risk of voter intimidation by people who go to collect these ballots. But what the political party that was having you turn in the ballots to the box was doing is simply being more efficient in how those ballots were being harvested. Calling it official created a problem, but if they take the ballot themselves and put it in the box, as long as they're returning them to the county clerk within 3 days, that meets the new California requirement. I question the ballot harvesting rule altogether, because I think it places at risk the secrecy of the ballot, and it gives rise to potential voter intimidation concerns. But that's what the law in California now allows, and we did the last 2018 election under those new rules.
John, what you just said slides over dishonesty. They marked on the boxes official. They weren't official in any way we would understand that word. That was just plain dishonesty.
Was there any claim that they were not just simply collecting the ballots as they were lawfully allowed to do and turn them in? None. So they call it official Dropbox, and they took the official off after the challenge. But can they still collect those ballots under California's ballot harvesting rules? And the answer clearly under the rules, as the Democrats played it in 2018, certainly, is yes, they can.
John,
is there any requirement that limits who can collect those ballots and turn them in? The answer is no.
John, the problem I have with it, and obviously I don't reach the same level as the two of you do, but when you start allowing people to put boxes out, make them mimic the official boxes, even use the word official on the outside, I think you're really starting down a slippery slope. What's to stop one of the two political parties? What if the Democratic Party decided to do the same thing and place boxes in Republican strongholds in the Central Valley or in certain spots in Orange County or San Diego County, knowing that these were overwhelmingly Republican districts and there's no oversight to make certain that those ballots are being turned in per the regulation? I think we're starting down a slippery slope that we really have to rethink it. And candidly, the fact that those boxes were designated as official and made to mimic the looks of the county drop boxes is very troubling.
Well, then let's get rid of the ballot harvesting rules altogether, because the same people could go out door to door and collect those ballots, and you have the same problem. This is why until 2018, California had a rule that only immediate family members could turn those ballots in. You protect the secrecy of the ballot, and you get rid of voter intimidation. When California opened that up to ballot harvesting, and they were the first state in the country to do that, that created all of the risks you're talking about. So I agree with you. It's a huge problem, and I would get rid of the ballot harvesting rule altogether. Why would you allow union workers to go door to door to collect ballots? If that's not laying the groundwork for voter intimidation, I don't know what is. Why are we tolerating that in the state of California?
John, we can have two different discussions. One is, should California law be changed with regard to voter ballot harvesting? And the question is there a greater risk that it's going to lead to intimidation, or is there more of a benefit in terms of facilitating the ability of people to get their ballots in? But let me set that question aside. The other issue is there any conceivable reason for them to have marked boxes official when they weren't connected to the government? That's just fraud, and I think that's what I'm focusing on. That's just inexcusable.
I don't see that. You know, here's your – you can turn this in as an official place, and we'll turn the ballots in for you. You know, ballot harvesting rules makes that permissible. I don't see what the problem is, other than the broader problem. The ballot harvesting itself is grounds for concerns about fraud. And so, you know, I don't see as, you know, going door to door and collecting the ballot as being any greater risk of fraud than putting a box out, say, drop your ballots here so we can turn it in for you, which
gentlemen,
is what they did.
Apologies. Gentlemen, can I jump in and slightly switch? But you keep saying a word that's triggering all around this in a slightly different context, and that's voter intimidation. And I'm sure Professor Eastman is going to say, I'm going to say this in a very slanted way, and he may be right here, but I'll let him call me on that after I'm done. There are a lot of people, minorities, that are claiming that they're feeling intimidated into not voting. By way of background, there was a consent decree governing the RNC dating back to the 80s when the Democrats accused the RNC of violating rights of Blacks and Latino voters. Court determined that the Republicans have placed off-duty police officers in some minority precincts and sent targeted mailings to minority voters warning them of penalties of violating election laws. That consent decree expired in 1918. We now have a president who many would claim is openly hostile towards minorities. When he was debating Joe Biden the first time, he made the statement in response to whether he would condemn white supremacists of Proud Boys, Stand Back and Stand By. The Proud Boys are a very openly white supremacist organization. They immediately got on all their public accounts and said, "Standing by, sir." And he's told his people to stamp, to watch the polls and watch people carefully. Every time I read the paper, they're talking about armed militias now going to the polls. And this is reminding me of some version of George Wallace. So I have a few questions here. The Chicago 7 was prosecuted for trying to incite a riot and going, arguably, peacefully protesting the 68 Democratic National Convention. These people are armed militia, and the president wants them to go to the polls to intimidate Blacks and Latinos. He has all but come out and said that. Is the president engaged in voter intimidation? Can this be used to challenge the results? Can the president be prosecuted or anyone else for what's happening right now?
Look, I mean, I got to push back on your premise. First of all, the president was asked in that debate, does he condemn white supremacy? And he said, sure, sure, sure. And they kept pressing. He said, name me the group. Proud Boys is not a white supremacist group. The head of it is a Puerto Rican, for heaven's sakes, with lots of Jewish members and lots of minority members. They are defenders of Western civilization. The notion that you would take that talking point out of the Southern Poverty Law Center's accusation that they're a hate group or a white supremacist group, I think is a biased premise of the whole question. The fact of the matter is this president has got higher polling numbers from among minority groups than Republicans almost ever have in my lifetime. So the notion that this is that there's some concerted effort at minority voter intimidation is just a Democrat talking point. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm not going to play that game. The fact of the matter is that the president is trying to ensure that we have an honest vote, that people who are not allowed to fraud. We just had a case in Pennsylvania. We've discovered 21,000 people still on the rolls who have been dead for a decade or more. And many of them have voter registrations that were made after they were dead. So, I mean,
whoa, stop. You told me that I'm going off and you're talking about dead people. That wasn't even close to the question.
No, I know. But when you talk about voter intimidation, when you talk about voter intimidation and you put out stories like that one, which is false, the president has condemned white supremacists over and over and over again. And you set that up as the premise of your question. The rest of your question, it loses credibility.
Don, you're just wrong on this. President Trump has repeatedly refused to condemn white supremacy.
That's not true, Erwin. It's just
blatantly. Don, I don't interrupt you.
I know, but it's just not true. It's just blatantly a lie.
Don, I don't interrupt you. You don't interrupt me. Let's each give each other.
And don't lie. Then don't lie blatantly.
Let him finish.
John, after Charlottesville, where President Trump was asked to condemn the white supremacists, he instead said, there's good people on both sides. He blatantly refused to condemn the white supremacists of Charlottesville.
That's just not true.
Hold on. We got to let him finish. It's only fair.
John, I could go and get the very words from President Trump after Charlottesville. I could go and get his words from the first debate against Joe Biden a couple of weeks ago. And his words with regard to the Proud Boys, who are a white supremacist group. And he said they should be ready. And this is about trying to get these armed right-wing militias to be at the polls to intimidate minority voters. You can defend Donald Trump all you want, but you can't deny that he's refused on so many occasions to condemn white supremacists.
It's just not true. Look at the fact of what he actually said. He said, I condemn white supremacists, I condemn the Nazis, but there were good people on both sides dealing with the issue of whether we should tear down the statues. And I'm looking for the exact quote. You are taking it as the snippet and not including the second sign, the second part of the sentence that he actually said. So don't play that game and perpetuate a false narrative of what was said.
John, can I ask you a question?
You sure. Can in a moment. Gentlemen, I need you to step aside and stand by. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. That's 415-989-1616 or sfbar.org.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we're discussing the constitutional implications of the 2020 elections. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. That is, any question relating to the constitutional implications of this moment in time. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. And Josh, I cut you off. You were about to ask another question.
I was, and after this, then we can move on to a new topic so we don't have to keep going around and around. But I do have a question. You're claiming that I took this whole thing out of context. When President Trump said to Joe Biden, "Proud Boy, stand back and stand by." That's the quote. And you're claiming I took this out of context. What did he mean?
Well, what was the start of the question? Do you condemn white supremacy? And what did he say? He said, sure, sure, sure. And then you haven't condemned it accurately. Do you actually condemn it? And he said, sure. Well, name me names. He said, okay, give me a group. And they said, Proud Boys. He said, I don't know who that Proud Boys is. Stand back, stand by. But that's after he had already said, do you condemn white supremacy? And he said, sure, sure, sure. I don't know how much clearer than that. Or we can go to the next debate, the town hall, when Savannah Guthrie asked him, do you condemn white supremacy? And he starts off by saying, I denounce white supremacy. I've done it for years. I always do that. And she says, well, I think that's ambiguous. Do you actually denounce them? And it's just, I mean, I don't know how many times the guy can say it. And the Charlottesville quote, again, completely taken out of context, as Irwin just did now. The question was, about people at the protest about whether we should remove statues or not. He said there are both side people of good good people on both sides of that. But I condemn the people, the Nazis, that tried to interfere with this. I condemn them. I mean, to say the quote about Charlottesville without including the second sentence is just patently dishonest.
Let me turn it to Irwin for a brief reply. I'd like to then take us away from the current talk where now we're focusing too much on the president and things that have been said. And I would like to focus more about the elections, the mechanics, where it's all leaving us, what it does to democracy. But Irwin, I want to give you a moment to sum up.
I'm glad to go back and look at Donald Trump's language after Charlottesville. And the consensus was he didn't condemn white supremacists. And I've just been looking online to find descriptions of the debate. And I found many Republican senators, staunch Republicans, criticizing President Trump for not denouncing white supremacy. And I want to go back to the question that you were asked, John. After it was pointed out that Southern Poverty Law Center labels Proud Boys a hate group, what did the president say? He said, I want them to stand back and stand by. Or we could talk about QAnon and President Trump's consistent refusal to condemn them. I think this is a president who embraces the white supremacist groups like Proud Boys, embraces groups like QAnon, and he should be held responsible for that.
So let's go to what he said in the town hall with Savannah Guthrie. She asked him point blank. He said, I denounce white supremacists. What about QAnon? He says, I don't know anything about it. But why won't you ask Joe Biden to condemn Antifa? Why and the violence of Antifa? Let's get off the political bias in the media on these things and start asking the questions of both sides and not taking people's statements out of context. When he repeatedly spent several minutes denouncing white supremacy in his town hall, and Savannah Guthrie just wouldn't accept the answer. And then all of a sudden, the news stories are he still refuses to condemn white supremacists. And Irwin, you said a minute ago, he never has responded by condemning white supremacists. I mean, go back and look at the transcript of that town hall. He does it repeatedly. Go look at the actual transcript of the first debate. When he's asked, do you condemn white supremacy? He says, sure, sure, sure. I mean, how much more is that's a direct condemnation of it, but it's not the narrative that you want to push out, and so we're going to pretend it didn't happen. This is craziness.
Actually, I think the complete quote was, I don't know much about QAnon, but then he went on to say how hard they fight against pedophilia. He thinks that that's a good thing. Let me turn it over to a caller. I've got William from Belvedere on the line. William, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm sometimes struck by what might be called the spaghetti on the wall effect, where somebody throws a whole bunch of stuff on the wall and sees how much sticks. The gentleman made a statement that there were 24,000 people registered in Pennsylvania who were dead. Well, that's not strange, because often they don't take people off of the rolls. But then he said many of them registered after they were listed as dead. So I want to ask him, out of the 24,000, and I'll bet you don't have the figures, how many is many? Was it two? Was it 220? Was it 2,000? How many? And so, first of all, do you have that answer?
No, but I've got the spreadsheet up, and I can give it to you within about 3 minutes. So if you'll hold.
That's fine. Well, in 3 minutes, I will be off the line, but please do it. The next thing is,
it was more than negligible.
Kobach,
it was thousands. And there are of the 21,000, roughly 5,000 had been dead and still on the rolls for more than a decade, which was demonstration
that
they are not doing
whether they voted or on the rolls is not the issue.
I'm giving you a second.
Now you're changing it.
Yeah, I'm giving you a second piece of the problem. But yes, I'll give you the exact numbers and you can.
The fact. I don't need the problem. I need the fact. Well, while you're doing that, and what number of that was actually the son who had the same name as the father? Or
well,
was it the Kurt Kobach approach, where they took people who were registered in two different states and contended that they were the same person?
So here's the very sophisticated analysis that was done to get to the 21,200. By the Public Interest Legal Foundation, working on the Social Security Death Index,
Hang on,
you asked me a question, and I'll finish. The fields that were compared were first name, middle initial, last name, date of birth, as well. And so I don't think the father and the sons have the same date of birth in these things. And that produced a 21,206 people on the Pennsylvania rolls who were still on the rolls and had deceased. And these weren't recently dead, which you would have, they just hadn't been able to get the list clean. A good number of these, nearly 50%, had been on the rolls for more than a decade after their deaths.
Sure, after they were dead.
After they were dead, yeah.
Well, that's what you said. You said of that number, many, used the word many.
I know, and I'm trying to get you the exact.
After they were dead. So I'm asking you, out of the 24,000, how many do you have listed as registered after they were dead? Because the other thing has nothing to do with whether there was illegal voting. It has to do with the voting authorities not being quick enough to find out who died.
There's two issues there. How many did they not remove from the votes because they were not even bothering to check the Social Security Death Index?
It has nothing to do with whether they voted or not, or whether they didn't vote, they were dead. Somebody voted for.
I'll tell you how many. Hang on. I'll tell you how many we had that voted.
Of the people who were dead.
Yeah. Give me a second, and I'm trying to pull it up right now.
I want to be sure that we spell it out, because you said many, so I'd like to know how many.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, I'm trying to do it.
And you apparently would like to know also.
I'm trying to do it on the fly here, so give me a second, and I will get you the number as soon as I can. It's a little hard to do it on the fly, because I've got a spreadsheet that has lots of different columns in it.
Well, but you made a statement. One would think that if you make a statement, the word many out of 24,000 you think, oh, 5,000 went on voting or went on being voted for after they were dead. But,
okay,
you know, so many, that's pretty impressive.
That begs a question.
Not, or it's
that,
nothing.
That begs a follow-up question, William, and that is, what safeguards are in place in Pennsylvania to catch voters who voted on behalf of the deceased, who voted for people that don't live there? And does that alleviate some of the problem? And the other thing is, I don't see this. I don't want to minimize what it means to have people on the voter rolls that shouldn't be there, either because they've passed away or because they're duplicative or perhaps they don't live in that area. But this is not a new problem that's unique to where we are now. It's not unique to voting during the pandemic. It's not unique to changes in rules or things along the way as a result of either the pandemic or one of the parties moving, taking advantage. This is a very typical situation that we hear virtually every election. What's different about
number.
It now?
Voted in the 2016 election after death, a date of death, 138. Those that had registered after the date of death, which I think is pretty significant, 251.
But did I hear you say that 138 voters voted posthumously?
Cast votes in the 2016 election after their date of death.
Well, John, I don't want to belabor this too much and spend too much time on this issue, but we're talking about a state which is one of the larger states in the nation. It has millions of voters, and we're talking about 138 votes.
But you're talking about people who have cast votes after they died. That ought to be a problem. That ought to be a problem.
It should be a problem. It sounds like a problem for local prosecutors rather than a problem to really get spending this much time on when we have some more serious questions about things that are happening right now, unique to this moment in time, whether it's because of the pandemic or the like. We're down to just a few minutes, and I'd really like to move forward into other things. We're almost out of time. And I see Josh has a finger up.
That's fine. I was just responding to the question from your caller who asked for numbers because I said many.
I appreciate it.
38 is many.
Yeah. William, thank you for joining us. I think you did a great job of fleshing out that we're talking about a very small number relative to the millions of voters in that state. Josh, what were you going to ask?
And I'm from Pennsylvania. We do our best. That said, President Trump has made it clear that he may not accept the results of this election. So what happens if we get down to election time and he simply says, I don't accept that? I'm not leaving office. Maybe he challenges with a lawsuit. Maybe he demands a recount. Regardless, he refuses to leave. Maybe this whole thing is still going on, unlike with Bush versus Gore, by the time the next president is supposed to take office. What happens in all these situations?
Josh, that's another example of a biased question because Hillary Clinton. Hang on. Hillary Clinton has advised Joe Biden, don't concede no matter what, no matter what, no matter what. And you don't ask the question about the Biden camp taking the same position.
Trump has never said he can't leave the White House. He's not there. I'm asking what happens if
But you're asking, is he going to accept the results of the election? Why do you phrase the question as only if President Trump will accept the results of the election? Why not both candidates? Will they accept the results of the election? I mean, for heaven's sakes, Trump was asked that in 2016 and he said, you know, it depends. If the election looks like it's being stolen, then no, I'm not going to accept the results. We need to know that. But it was Hillary Clinton's camp that for 4 years has acted as though they weren't accepting the results of the election. So ask a fair question that deals with it on both sides, because you got those concerns on both sides. Don't skew it one direction rather than the other.
I think Erwin Chemerinsky is dying to come in, and I'm going to let him.
John, this is the first time, not just in our lifetime, but in American history, that there's a significant number of people who believe that even if the incumbent president loses, he's going to refuse to leave office. And Donald Trump has fueled that by refusing to answer the question, will he accept the results of the election? Going back to John Adams in 1800, every incumbent president who's lost has left office, and even left office relatively graciously. Most recently, George H.W. Bush in 1992. That the Attorney General of the United States says they'll accept the results only, if, and I'm quoting Barr here, if the results are clear. I think the answer to the question is If the Electoral College deems Joe Biden is the president, he will be regarded by the courts as the president of the United States. If Donald Trump doesn't leave office then, maybe who controls the military, but we'll then see something that makes us much like countries we don't admire politically. And I just hope that it doesn't come to that.
Irwin, I don't know what you're smoking. That's insane. The president has never said if the election is clear, he wouldn't leave office. That's a talking point on the left that you guys are making this stuff up. What he has challenged is if people look like they are putting in fraudulent ballots to try and throw the election, then of course I'm not going to accept that. I mean, this is a pretty simple thing to understand. And of course, nobody should accept a fraudulent election as being outcome determinative. But if the election is fair and if the election produces a result, the notion that this president isn't going to leave and is going to have to be escorted out of the White House by the military, that's laughable. It's laughable. And you ought to be ashamed of yourself for perpetuating such a false narrative to try and get people to stand her up.
John, has he ever stated what he meant by challenging?
We don't insult each other.
I know, but what you're saying is insulting, Irwin, to make those kind of false claims against the sitting president of the United States and to perpetuate a false narrative as if it's true. And you know what? I'm not going to sit here and take that kind of stuff.
John, it's Donald Trump who's repeatedly refused to say that he'll accept the results of the election. It's the attorney general who said we'll accept it only if we think the results are clear. That's where the word clear comes from. It's Donald Trump who has fueled this. I've never seen in my lifetime questions about whether an incumbent president would leave office before. And it is Trump that has fueled that concern. And this, to me, is a concern about whether our democracy will survive.
Well, and they still haven't accepted the results of the 2016 election. We've seen a perpetual effort to undermine this president. And when Hillary Clinton gets up and gives a speech and say Joe Biden should not concede no matter what, not anything, the same kind of concerns could be raised on the other side. And yet you're focusing, as Joshua did here a moment ago, as if the president is the only one raising these questions. We have a serious question about whether we're going to have a legitimate election, and we ought to get beyond it. But the notion that this president would not step down if he loses the election and it's a legitimate election and there's not massive fraud that could turn the election, it's just preposterous. And so quit pushing out that narrative. It is undermining the credibility of the election that we all need to come together to do. And it undermines it just as much as Hillary Clinton getting out there and saying Joe Biden should not concede no matter what.
John, the difference is that Donald Trump is in the White House. And the question is, if he loses, will he leave office?
And of course he will. Of course he will. And he's never said he would.
Let him finish. Come on.
The question is, will Donald Trump leave the White House? That isn't a question about whether Joe Biden is going to leave the White House. It's Donald Trump who has fueled that concern by what he has said. And the question of who's going to determine whether it's a fair election? It sounds like if Donald Trump perceives it's not a fair election, Donald Trump isn't going to leave office. And I don't think any of us can deny there is a concern in this country right now about whether Donald Trump will leave office that we have never had before in American history, but whether an incumbent president who loses would leave office.
Well, you can take that narrative and think it's true, but it's false. It's put out there to scaremonger people. And quite frankly, I'm not going to play that game with you, Irwin. I'm really disappointed in you for perpetuating that. He has not said he would not leave office if he loses the election. It's just false. And you ought to quit putting that out there because it undermines people's faith in the result of the election. It's not what Trump's doing. It's this false narrative that's being put out there to try and distort what he has actually said. The concern is that people are, you know, let's go back to look at Box 13, the infamous Box 13 with Lyndon Johnson's thing. After the election, he's short on votes, and we find this magic absentee ballot. Or look at the congressional district number 2 in New Mexico last year. Or look at the Washington governor's race from a decade ago. These are serious concerns about people stealing elections. And of course, no candidate should say, if it looks like the election is being stolen, I'm not going to accept the results. We want to make sure we have a fair election. But he has never said, and I doubt would ever say, that if it's a fair election and I lose it, I'm not leaving the White House. And we ought not to perpetuate that myth as if it's got some truth to it.
I have a question on a little different note. And if anyone wants to point a finger for perpetuating it, it was my question. Feel free to blame me. I can also see Irwin Chemerinsky. He's not smoking anything, for the record, by the way. But here is my question for anyone who wants to answer. People are suing the president left and right for all sorts of things that have to do with his office and don't have to do with his office. People are dying to go after him for tax evasion, state and federal, everyone under the sun. Here's my question. Can the president pardon himself on the way out for everything and give himself a clean slate?
No one knows the answer to that question because no president has ever tried to do it. If the president tried to pardon himself, there would undoubtedly be litigation over it. I think there's an argument that says pardon through history has been something that people give to others. But I've also heard the possibility that Trump would resign 5 minutes before noon when his term ends and let Mike Pence pardon him for everything to avoid this issue.
But again, why ask the question on only that direction? Would Joe Biden, if he's elected president, pardon himself and his son for the scandalous deals that are now coming out with respect to China? You won't ask that question because you're trying to make it all about Trump. But we have
not a hypothetical. President Trump is the one who's going to have the chance to do this.
If Biden gets elected, he would have the chance to do it as well. So why don't you ask the question in an even manner that addresses both sides? One part of it furthers a narrative and the other side exposes a narrative that you don't want exposed. And quite frankly, I'm really disappointed that you would ask such a biased, one-sided question.
I'm a horrible person. If he does it, do you stand by him on the way out and say that's what he wanted to do? He's the president.
I don't see that he's conducted any criminal activity. Whereas I think the evidence coming out of the pay to play with Hunter Biden and Joe Biden is intense. You know, and that's true whether Twitter tries to block it or not. But why don't we ask questions about that serious challenge? Because there's a narrative out here that you're trying to perpetuate. And I'm keep pushing out against it because I'm not buying into it.
Nobody has the pardon power but for the sitting president. I'm going to have to cut everybody off because we're out of time. I want to give everybody a chance to have something to say before they leave. Let me turn it first to Brad Hertz. You've been waiting patiently and unable to really get a word in. Unfortunately, we're way low on time. Can you take 2 to 3 minutes max for any closing thoughts? And tell us a little about how you advise clients in the light of this, not only the pandemic, but this atmosphere out here and how toxic it is. How did they get their word across? How do they protect?
Sure, Jeff.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I was going to say, I think I might know how Chris Wallace felt at the first debate. But it's been very lively. And because the show is called Your Legal Rights, I think voters should know they have a large number of rights to have their legal ballots counted, to not be intimidated or even campaigned toward at the polls within 100 feet of the polls, to monitor their absentee ballot and make sure it gets in. If their signature is deemed not to have matched their voter registration signature, and they might otherwise be disenfranchised. In California, at least, they're supposed to be notified by the registrars and have a chance to rehabilitate that ballot. No one should be intimidated while they're voting or while they're turning in their ballot. And so what we advise people is know your rights, whether it's that you're allowed time off from your job to vote, that you obviously, if you spoil a ballot and you didn't mean to vote a certain way, there's a vehicle for requesting an alternate ballot and obviously not voting twice. But there are rights that are available to voters that they should know. Obviously, a lot of this will ultimately come down to the public will and determining that and hopefully determining it that way and not via the courts. But it's been a very lively discussion, and I hope we all survive this election as we have other ones.
Dean Chemerinsky, any words that you'd like to close? Maybe 2 minutes.
The hope is that the November 3rd election won't be close. It won't need to go to state legislatures. It won't need to go to courts. The more John yells and screams in all of this, the more I too feel like Joe Biden in the debate. The more he tries to talk over me, the reality is that Donald Trump is the greatest threat to American democracy of any president in history. And I hope people will keep that in mind when they go to vote on November 3rd.
Dr. Eastman, any last words? We have about 2 minutes.
Yeah. So you know, what's happening here is this president is challenging the status quo in ways we haven't seen in a long time. it's not a surprise that people within the administration, in his own administration, have been actively working against him almost from the beginning, from Inauguration Day. The greatest political scandal in American history is the prior administration spying on their political opponent. People have not yet gone to jail, but the evidence on that is palpably clear. And now we have one of the biggest pay-to-play scandals in American history involving the Democrat nominee for president. And we've got our major media organizations and our major social networking platforms trying to shut down that story when we're 2 weeks out from an election. I think this is a great danger to our ability to get the information we as citizens need to make an educated decision on November 3rd. And I hope the major media will start allowing for the kind of stories that are out there to get the fair airing and the full airing that the American people need to make their decision on November 3rd.
Josh Berger, any last minute, any last comments?
People who came into this country for freedom are scared and think about going home, and that's just sad. I second Professor Chemerinsky's emotions.
I wasn't planning on commenting at the end, but one thing that comes to mind, which I think is the single greatest threat to our democracy, is our lack of cohesion and the fact that right now you hear how polarized we are. These are extraordinarily competent and educated individuals. You can imagine what it's like with less educated individuals on the street. We're extraordinarily divided, and most people are watching and listening to media that directly reflects and reinforces the opinions that they already have, rather than listening to news from the other side or that might not agree with the opinions they already have. And as long as that remains the case, it's going to be very, very difficult for any of us to come together and try and work constructively at some of the real problems we would have. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been discussing the constitutional implications of the 2020 elections. Our guests tonight have been, on leave from Chapman University and currently the visiting scholar on conservative thought and policy, we have Dr. John Eastman. And courtesy of the Sutton Law Firm, Bradley Hertz, the past president of the California Political Lawyers Association, and Dean Erwin Chemerinsky from the Berkeley School of Law, Jesse Choper, distinguished professor of law. Joining me tonight as co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Berger. I'd like to thank each of you. Next week again at our new time, we'll be here on Your Legal Rights to discuss business and immigration. Our show tonight's been produced by Josh Berger and yours truly. And I once again want to give a big thank you to all of our distinguished guests, Professors Erwin Chemerinsky, John Eastman, and Bradley Hertz, and to tonight's co-host, Josh Berger, at the controls, Debbie Kennedy. And a special thanks to all of you for joining us. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your particular situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.